and welcome to Introducing Me. I'm your host, Sarah. I started this podcast to get to know other people and lifestyles while discovering more about myself. Each episode, I will give a new guest a chance to discuss their background, culture, interests, or whatever they want to talk about to help increase all of our own worldviews. Today, I would like to introduce you to Cecilia. Cecilia and I went to college together, and I'm super grateful that she answered my message of like, hey, do you want to do this with me? Cecilia is currently living in Germany, so we got to work around the time change to find a time to record this episode. So we'll talk a little bit about that and just different things in her life. So I'm really excited to have her here today. So thank you, Cecilia. Why don't you say hello and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Sarah, for having me. I'm really happy to have a chance to be here. I am from Connecticut originally, from Central Connecticut, New Britain specifically, which is right outside of Hartford, the capital. I went to Susquehanna in Pennsylvania, class of 2017, although I actually ended up graduating in the fall of 2016. Having finished up some of my credits early, I studied creative writing. That was my bachelor's degree with minors in music, vocal performance specifically, Italian, the Italian language, and English literature. And then I went back to Connecticut to do a master's degree in English literature, which also took me overseas for a semester to England. And then I came back, finished the degree, and then wound up moving to Berlin, Germany, in July of 2019, where I have been living to this day.
It sounds like you have been doing so much since you entered college.
I have never stopped. It has been a wild ride that has taken me more places than I bargained for, literally.
Yes, definitely. Now, all of the minors at Susquehanna, can you talk about why you chose each of those focuses?
Sure. Well, I know that you, for instance, completed the Bachelor of Arts in Music alongside your business degree, which is a nice way, as you've talked about, I know, to combine your various interests and passions in a way that doesn't completely rob you of sleep and sanity. I had flirted with the music BA myself at Susquehanna, given that it was so compatible with other degrees, but I ended up not having time to finish all of those credits. So I dropped the music to a minor, but that was really kind of some management issues on my part. And I would have liked to complete it if I could, just because music is such a key factor in my life. Oh, there's a pun, key. but it has played such a huge role in my life that I sort of place it on a level, on an equivalent level with writing, if not above it. But I'd always wanted to stay involved in music. I'd always wanted to continue to grow and deepen my relationship with it. So it was sort of self-explanatory. It was something I was always going to do in some capacity from the very beginning. Italian, I had been studying since high school. I'd started it in freshman year of high school. And my family are Italian on my father's side, 100%. So I had always kind of sought to develop a relationship with it. And since I already had it from high school, and I sort of had a facility and a passion for studying languages to begin with, it was something that I wanted to stay in touch with, certainly. And then the English literature was a nice companion to the creative writing, in that the writing program was very heavily concentrated on the contemporary market and on what people were writing nowadays and reading nowadays and what the market was interested in, and kind of playing to that market as emerging writers ourselves. But I also wanted to read old stuff. You know, I wanted to read Chaucer and Jane Austen and Oscar Wilde and people like that. And I got a wonderful chance to do that by participating in the English minor. And then I did the honors program as well, which sort of actually combined some elements of all three of those disciplines plus some others. So I've never been able to choose between things, and Susquehanna really allowed me to indulge my indecisiveness.
Yes, it's great that Susquehanna is able to do that. And as you mentioned, like, you know, I got two degrees in two completely different disciplines that very, very little overlapped. Now, have you had a chance to use your Italian in the real world?
Actually, I have in some minor practical ways, I would say. As a matter of fact, the next door neighbors to my parents' house, whom I spent a large chunk of my youth and young adulthood alongside, they are immigrants from Italy. So I was able to, when we would go over and visit, I was able to speak with them with more and more confidence. And they were delighted to hear that I was developing in the language. I've also used it to some extent since I've been in Berlin. There are many Italian immigrants here. Berlin is a very international city in any respect, I should mention. But given that Italy is a fairly close neighbor to the south, there are a lot of Italians who just sort of end up migrating here for one reason or another. And there are communities who really go out of their way to speak it. So I've gotten involved in them tangentially, even though I also really need to be perfecting my German, which is a slow but sure process. I've used it the least in my own family because most of them have little to no grasp of the language anymore. First of all, the textbook Italian, which is really what I was studying, is more based in sort of the proper language of the North. And my family come from the South, specifically from the regions of Calabria and Puglia, which are sort of in the arch of the boot, if you're visualizing a map of Italy. I have a lot of friends with Sicilian ancestry from the island of Sicily. And that is not where we're from, but sort of adjacent to it or almost adjacent, kind of nearby. And the language there is very different. It's much more stunted and closed in terms of vowel sounds. So there can be some communication breakdown to begin with. But the story of my family emigrating from there to the United States was that my grandparents who were born in the United States, kind of on the East Coast, learned from a young age to assimilate and to practice their English as often as they could. And that was, of course, to the detriment of their proficiency in Italian. So that by the time they were, only my grandma is left now, but by the time she has reached the age that she is now, she speaks Italian rarely, if ever. So one would think that I might have the most occasion to practice it among my own kin, but actually the exact opposite has happened.
Right. But that's really cool that your neighbors growing up were Italian and you had people like right there while you were learning it in school that you could then actually converse with.
Yeah. I was really grateful to have sort of that transplant or kind of an opportunity that was supplanted where my family would not have been. And my family all lived very far away anyway, out of state and kind of in far flung regions. So I wouldn't have had as regular a chance to practice with them anyway.
Now, with a name like Cecilia, when you are in Germany, do people think you are Italian? Do they know that you're American? What sort of experience do you get when interacting with strangers? Because you also said you are still working on German.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's been a trying process. And German, I should mention, one would think that English being a Germanic language or derivative of the sort of Saxon languages that ended up comprising German, that it might be fairly easy to pick up German, and not so, I should say. It's got a lot of sort of very rigid rules, and people don't necessarily understand you if you get the order of certain words wrong. Or, you know, they'll mock you for it good-naturedly, but still it doesn't do a whole lot for your confidence. So learning German is a process in and of itself. But with a name like Cecilia Gigliotti, to pronounce it the Italian way, people will sometimes they'll see my name attached to something because oftentimes, you know, if you're going to various events and you sign up for it online or something, all they have is your online presence to go on. So they'll look at my name or they'll see me and you know, without having any frame of reference for me, without having any prior knowledge of me, they will assume automatically, they'll make the snap judgment that I'm from Italy and not that I'm from the States or not that my first language is English or anything. So it takes a bit of maneuvering, I would say. There are no, I think, specific anecdotes that I have to support that theory or to support that experience. But there's sort of this cognitive dissonance that occurs. And I, of course, am trying to make as good an impression as I can. Sometimes sometimes trying to speak German, or sometimes I will, I mean, I do consider myself, if not fluent, then at least with an advanced working knowledge of Italian. So sometimes I'll speak Italian to sort of assert my presence or assert the access that I have to the European experience and sustain that for as long as I can. But oftentimes there isn't really the chance to do that or the occasion. So I'll sort of end up speaking in a garbled mix of German and English until we, whomever it is that I'm speaking with, and I can come to some agreement on how to communicate. But this mix of cultures and this sort of judgment that does not take everything into account, which is what all judgments are really, makes for an interesting experience. And given that so many people in Berlin kind of speak so many different combinations of languages, it just adds to the polyglot mix.
Yes, it's definitely got to be something interesting to always be working through. Now, you mentioned the culture where you are. Mm-hmm. What has, I don't know, surprised you the most, or what is the most different thing that you have experienced since being in Germany for a little while now?
That's a really good question. Well, one thing, I mean, let's keep in mind, I had next to no knowledge of Berlin before arriving here. And I guess I should even explain why I was here to begin with, honestly. I came here because I had finished my degree, which was serendipitous timing, because I had been offered a job at a small startup. And Berlin is sort of a startup capital of the world, or at least of the West. A lot of people, especially for tech startups, actually, a lot of people tend to flock to Berlin because it's a particularly hospitable environment. It's a very artistic city. It's a very young city, actually. And it's full of young upstarts who want startups, which is a phrase I just came up with now. So I was offered a job actually writing and adapting fiction for a small publishing startup, essentially. They began life as an online publishing forum. What they were doing was adapting stories from that forum, working with the authors who had originally created those stories online, and adapting them for an immersive app platform where you can read the stories and kind of listen to sound effects as it goes on and just tap through and read a chapter a day. So sort of this new, even more portable way of interacting with fiction. And the company itself was very international. English was sort of its primary language. The founders, there was one founder whose family had come from Lebanon originally, but he has been in Germany for a while and is proficient in the language. The other founders were Canadian. So they came over and had very little knowledge of German and are still kind of working on it, I think. And a number of my fellow writers were, we all basically, English was our native language. And we came from various places, some from America, some from the States, some from Canada, some from the United Kingdom, some from Australia. And so just the international mix was something that I was not necessarily prepared for because I didn't have a lot of knowledge of Berlin coming in. I had visited Germany before. Actually, I should mention Susquehanna's GO program, the Global Opportunities Program, which had taken me to Austria in the summer of 2016 for a small period, a period of about 4 weeks. But we had flown into Germany and then kind of crossed the border from there, spent a little bit of time in München, in Munich. But my experience of the German language had been Austrian German, which differs in many ways from Germany German. And I realized sort of the primary thing I realized once I arrived in Berlin was that Berlin is no more representative of Germany than, say, London is representative of England. And quite honestly, I haven't done a tremendous amount of traveling outside of Berlin, even before, because I had been here about 9 months before lockdown. And then certainly since lockdown, the number of places I've gone has shrunk significantly. But just the history of Berlin, which is kind of a world famous history, but the things that people know about it are limited, I would say, limited to the wall and the the rise of the wall in 1961, the fall of the wall in 1989, and some of the separational and then sort of integrational events surrounding those. And the fact is that, I mean, I was here to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Mauerfall, the fall of the wall, last November. And the fact is that the international community in Berlin has really become the essence of the city. It's what it's all about at this point. And so I used to live in a neighborhood that was heavily Turkish, a lot of Turkish population here, immigrant population. While I was with the company, we went on a retreat to a castle in Poland, and Berlin is very close to the Polish border, so just a few hours drive, and we were there. So having that influence and that access right to the east, that is a heavy influence on the city and on the aesthetic of the city, and even sort of the division of Berlin itself, because you can tell. You can sort of tell, I mean, with such a turbulent history as it's had, the story of the city, especially architecturally, has changed dramatically even over the past, 75 years, certainly the last century. You cross from the western, I mean, Berlin is planted firmly in the eastern half of the country. So West-East speaking, capitalism, communism speaking, it would have been entirely in Soviet country, except that that they chose to divide the city as well. And at this point, I have lived in both former West Berlin and former East Berlin. I'm in the eastern half now. And you can even tell a lot of the buildings have been replaced over time, but you can see the ghosts of sort of Soviet architecture, DDR architecture. And sort of it's a little more severe, a little more boxy. That's sort of a Berlin pun, actually, because there's a famous square in this section of the city called Boxhagener Platz, which people refer to as boxy. So it's literally boxy. And you can sort of discern, even if you're not actively learning, you can passively discern and absorb the history of the city and the ways in which it was separated and has since been reintegrated through its buildings. So just the fact that the remnants of the conflict that has happened here and the fact that Berlin has been such a site and such a focal point for division and union and all sorts of action on the world stage is something that I had not been prepared for and could not have been prepared for in any way except coming here and becoming intimate with it.
Yeah, I feel like I got a little bit of a history lesson there. When I think about Germany, like you said, I think about the wall. I think about Oktoberfest. Mm-hmm. I have an aunt who is German, and I'm like, I should know about more about Germany than I do. So you mentioned that...
Where in Germany is she from?
Oh, God, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question. I do not know. I do know, it's my belief, like, she's not from Berlin. I believe she's mm-hmm. more like, it was more of an out in the country sort of thing. But yeah, like, all of her family is there. My uncle, her husband, was over there during the war and swept her off her feet, married her, and brought her to the States. So
very nice. Wunderbar.
So yeah, so... you mentioned that during your time in grad school, you spent a semester in England. So how did that compare? How did that come about?
Yes. Well, England, I'm always down to talk about England. London has been one of my favorite cities in the whole world for 6 years now, ever since I first visited in the winter of 2014. And I've loved it as well because of its many layers. I think London has some layers in the way that Berlin does not have, simply because Berlin was such a central point of World War II, and much of it was just razed to the ground and had to be physically rebuilt over the course of time. London, of course, participated in the Second World War, but more of it was retained, just architecturally speaking and physically speaking. So you can even see scars on the buildings from the bombings and from action like the Victoria and Albert Museum, for example, in South Kensington, which is one of my, if not my very favorite museum in the whole world. The sides of the building, the stone is pockmarked from having been struck and hit by falling, I don't know, shrapnel falling, things falling from the sky during the Blitz. So just the layers upon layers of civilization that have accumulated there over the course of centuries, even because it was a Roman outpost as well, a Londinium, as it was called at that time. And just the fact that it has survived and so much of it has been intact for hundreds and hundreds of years has always just captivated me. And everyone's voices, of course, which I could listen to all day. But then you kind of venture outside. I spent a semester at a university in Hatfield, which is a suburb of London. It's about a 20-minute train ride out. You take the northbound service to Cambridge, and it's right there. And it just becomes much smaller town. The world just becomes much smaller, and people's worldviews become much smaller, and things become there's more homogeneity, I suppose. People begin to look the same. People begin to sound the same. And just, I think, the impressions of the world become a lot smoother and a lot more uniform. But even so, you've got, I had a friend whom I would go and visit out in Kenilworth, which is in the Midlands. And there's a field there. There's like a several hundred year old field that Oliver Cromwell used as a training ground that people just pass every day. There's a castle there. There are castles all over England from the feudal days. But there are fortresses that continue to crumble and continue to deteriorate before people's eyes to this very day. But that are still sites of interest and that are living remnants of history that people can see. And being able to observe some of those contrasts, to be reductive about it, city life versus country life. And just to be able to observe the impact of the past on both of those environments and both of those types of environments was really remarkable. And I mean, part of the reason I was there to begin with, I was there to take classes, but then I was also, I traveled around the country doing research for my master's thesis, which involved comparing the works of Lewis Carroll, who is the author of the stories that we know as Alice in Wonderland, and John Lennon, his songwriting, his poetry, and other writing that he did. And so I went to Oxford to look at Carroll's papers, to look through some of the work that he had left behind. I went to Liverpool and saw all of the Lennon-related sites. I may or may not have cried several times. And just to observe the once again, just the accumulation of effects, of demographic effects and geographical effects and topographical, all of the graphs, all of the studies of things that had brought these communities to where they are and that had evolved them to the point that they have been. And Oxford is still a relatively small town. It's a focal point for various reasons, especially the university, but it's still retained kind of its small town quaintness, so to speak, or its charm. And Liverpool is still a bustling northwestern port city. It's still important in many ways. In the past half century, it's become even more important than the reputation that it had enjoyed previously. So it's just remarkable. And for anyone who is interested in art or anthropology or the effects of humanity, on the earth and the earth on humanity, it's just a phenomenal thing to ponder, and it's all around you when you travel to a place like that.
Definitely. As you were talking, I was just like, wow, I really miss being in England, and I miss all of, like, I'm not a big history buff, but like you talking about all this stuff, I'm like, it is so beautiful. It is so nice. And especially with the pandemic, like it's not like I'm going very far anyway.
Right. But I think sharpens the nostalgia and makes it all the more acute. I look through photos and I see even events that are still taking place. either online or in very limited in-person capacities. And I say, ah, if only I could be there. And my relationship to London is at this point much more casual. You know, I stayed behind a little while after finishing the semester, moved into the city for about a month, and ostensibly started work on the thesis on the paper that I was writing. But even then, and at that point, I felt like I knew the city better than I knew any city. And then, you know, only a few months later to turn around and come to a city I had never visited, which I now know even more intimately, arguably, than I ever knew London or have ever known London. And yet there's still so much of Berlin that I feel that I've only scratched the surface. And we're now in another stage of partial lockdown here as well. And have been since the beginning of November. I think the hope is that if everyone behaves themselves in November, that we can open some things up in time for the holidays, particularly the famous Berlin Christmas markets, Weihnachtsmarkt, which are these stalls and these things that look very quintessentially German. You would look at it and say, yes, that is kind of resembles the Bavarian snow-capped picturesqueness that I am familiar with, or that I associate with Germany, because I think a lot of people's associations with Germany are associations with Bavarian country, pretzels, all that good stuff. Yeah, I don't remember exactly where I was going with that, but the point being that you can spend however much time in a city, and still not feel like you know it, as a matter of fact, if you feel that way, that's probably a sign that you're doing something right.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you want, you know, there's of course all the touristy things, which you may or may not do, but then there's so much more to learn. And it's interesting because you mentioned the Christmas markets, and the town that I live in, Mifflinburg, Pennsylvania, we have a Christmas market. The Chris Kindle Market, which is based on German heritage because Mifflinburg is very based on German heritage. And we canceled the market. It has been canceled 4 months. But just the logistics in terms of planning, and it is, I don't know if you've ever been to it, but like for people, of course, who haven't, it is on a very small street, very crowded, no space. You know, you are, if it's good weather, you are bustling around people, and they have the barns and the thing that you mentioned. So it's not just all open air, and you can get into it from so many different directions. And it's just like, we're not doing a great job with the pandemic, the United States.
So I've heard.
And you know, there's lots of different reasons. And it's, you know, like I am following protocol, I am being safe, but you go out and you see so many people that aren't. And so it's just this really hard thing. And so I definitely have been very curious to see how Europe handles everything going into winter. And as you said, you are back in another phase of lockdown. So how has lockdown and the pandemic been for you being in Germany?
Well, the foremost thing that has happened to me because of lockdown was that I was laid off from the job. So this company that had brought me here, me and several of my fellow writers, sort of the whole content team, as we call them, because there were writers and sound designers. About a third of us were laid off because the company was suffering financially and couldn't maintain all of us. And so that was hard. Not that I expected to be at the job forever, but it had been just under a year that I'd been working there, and I had really hoped to have a longer relationship with them, but sometimes hard choices need to be made. I understood it. But the other thing was that the visa that I had was tied to that job. And so thus began what I can charitably describe as a rigmarole of figuring out what to do with the visa that I had, how to get what visa I even wanted to switch to begin with, how to go about obtaining that visa and what it would mean for my future in Berlin. Because my whole identity as a Berliner, well, not my whole identity, I try as a rule not to let work define my life and subsume it completely. But my identity as a Berliner was bound up with this job because it was the reason I was here to begin with. And I was involved in many other things. I would go to shows and concerts and plays and things like that. I was part of a choir and a ukulele orchestra, which was one of the joys of my life. And I mean, those have stopped as well. So like you, I've experienced a bit of artistic rechanneling, having to sort of reroute all of that artistic energy, creative energy into other things. But what it fell to me to do essentially was to, I had a little bit of time left on the other visa, which helped me to kind of keep things going. There were severance packages and things like that to keep things going while I researched and sort of put my energy toward obtaining a freelance visa, which is fairly easy to get if you have all of the right tools and if you're willing to put the time into cobbling all of the documents together, which I did. You had bank statements and letters of intent from employers and clients who needed you to do things for them. So I created a profile on a freelance site and got to work writing for people, doing blog posts and editing jobs and little projects that gave me a lot of variety. And I've enjoyed doing a lot of those if the income hasn't necessarily been what it was and if the security isn't necessarily what it was. So if slightly less stable, the freelance life has been a fulfilling one and an enjoyable one and a tenable one. It's managed to sustain me. And in the middle of pursuing this freelance visa, which sort of took the course of the summer, I actually was offered another full-time job. I interviewed with another company and was offered the job and accepted the job. It then was incumbent upon me to submit paperwork to the Ausländerbehörde, which is the sort of the immigration office, to change the name of the employer that my previous visa had been attached to. They, like every government office in Berlin, have been backed up like nobody's business because of the pandemic and processing all sorts of paperwork that they didn't have to before and just severely, severely behind in the work that they had to do. And for some reason, I was not on their priority list, even though what they would have had to do to change the name of the employer on my visa was, I think, minimal. And they didn't do it in time. It took weeks of, I kept getting on the phone with everyone I could, trying to figure out what was going on. I could never really get a definitive answer. And eventually, the company, who had never hired an American before, by the way, so I think that my visa situation was more complicated than some others. I wouldn't be surprised if it was. Eventually, the company had to reopen their search and offer the position to someone else, presumably, again, with a less complicated visa situation. And that was a big disappointment just because I thought that it could have been avoided. So then in the meantime, it was back to the drawing board in terms of a freelance visa. So I worked with an immigration lawyer who was exceedingly patient and kind and helpful. And we managed to get together all of the requisite documents. It then took a while to actually secure an appointment at one of the locations of the Ausländerbehörde, the Bürgeramt, as they're also known. And I had the appointment finally on October 20th, 6 months after being laid off originally. I went in with all of the paperwork and came out a few minutes later with a statement saying that I would be granted the freelance visa, which I am currently awaiting in the mail. So think about the fact that getting a whole new visa, being approved for a whole new visa, was apparently doable in a way that simply making a modification to the old visa was not. That's something that will never make sense to me. I imagine that even if I spend a lot more time in Berlin, that the bureaucracy will remain a mystery to me, as it remains a mystery to many of my native German friends. They're just like, oh, you know, anytime they can wait until the very last minute to do something, they do. And, you know, don't worry if you don't hear from them, because it always takes a lot more time than it should. And it's just something that I think a lot of Germans, and therefore a lot of expats, have to resign themselves to. So that was a whole story. That was kind of the preeminent worry on my mind, or the thing on my mind, until quite recently. And in the meantime, I've been trying to amuse myself however I can. We've been in various stages of lockdown and unlockdown. We never even sort of at the height of summer, when people could be out and about safely and the weather was nice, we weren't exactly returning to the uninhibited going here and going there lifestyle that we had been accustomed to before lockdown. And I should say that we went into lockdown originally mid-March, which I think seems kind of on time, contemporaneous with much of the rest of the world, which had not been affected already, I guess. And so it was several months of kind of slowly reopening from where we had been, but it was never back up to the level of just go wherever you want to go and do whatever you want to do. And, you know, I went to a couple museums and a couple other places, and even like at restaurants and bars, when you weren't eating or drinking, you had to be masked. And going into the museums, you had to wear a mask. So I think Germany has been sort of a beacon for the world, or sort of has set an example or served as a model of how to handle the pandemic. And even then, it hasn't been perfect. And there have been some anti-masker demonstrations, or had been when the weather was warm. So people were getting fed up here. And it wasn't just like everyone kind of accepting it and being like, okay, we'll wear a mask as long as they have to. People were getting antsy after a certain period of time. But for the most part, I think people understand that it's for the common good. And I guess that also isn't to say that there weren't some quote unquote spreader events. There had been a wedding a while back, like a single wedding near Frankfurt, that caused a significant spike in cases. And the number of cases has sort of naturally risen as the weather has gotten colder, because people have gone inside, which I think is one of the other things that precipitated this month's lockdown. So it's been alternately pretty lonely and okay. I've also moved a couple times during the pandemic, which it's pretty easy to move during a lockdown, because it's a little easier to schlep your things across a city that is not up to full capacity, or where people are largely staying indoors, as opposed to just being uninhibited out and about. So, and I don't have a tremendous amount of stuff to schlep anyway. So it's, and I've found other ways of amusing myself. I started a YouTube channel. I watched a lot of things on Netflix. I got back to pleasure reading, which I kind of tried to make time for anyway, but I had even more time to do it now. And I've just been looking for the work that I can do. And that seems to be, there seems to be a fair amount of demand for it, and for especially the types of writing and editorial skills that I have, which I feel very fortunate to be able to participate in. So lockdown, there's been, I feel differently about lockdown at various points in time, but I'm happy to do it if it keeps people safe.
Right. And I don't think anyone's experience has been the same at all for mm-hmm. these number of months. And it's really great to hear that you're doing well on the freelance visa, that you're getting the work, and you are sustaining all of that. Now, you just mentioned that you started a YouTube channel. So what is your YouTube channel, and what are you doing on it?
Yes, my YouTube channel is called Leah Leo. I took little portions of a portion of my first name and a portion of my last name, because I sort of wanted to try out a quote unquote stage name that was not a complete removal from my name, that still was true to myself and the essence of who I am in a way. And it's mostly been me covering songs just with voice and ukulele. So something very simple, pretty lo-fi, and something that has brought me a lot of joy. I started playing the ukulele in 2017 when my aunt gave me the ukulele for Christmas. I named my ukulele Uke Skywalker. And it's just become one of the primary creative forces of my life. It's allowed me to engage on an even deeper level with all the music that I already love. And it's helped me to become more of a songwriter and develop a songwriting personality in and of myself. Although I have yet to post any original content on the channel. But I still have relatively few videos up. I kind of only can get back to it every once in a while. But I spent so much time just playing and singing on my own that I thought it might be nice to share it with people.
Yeah, that's super great and super wholesome. Now, before we wrap up, there was something else that we had talked about beforehand that I did just kind of want to throw in there because you've seen the social media for the podcast. So I do ask everyone for a photo as long as they are willing to share it to help kind of just show the different people who guest with me. And I shared this with you that when we first met, as we were in the same professional music fraternity at Susquehanna, one of the things that you did when you introduced yourself was blatantly come out and say, like, I have an artificial eye, because, you know, if you have questions, I want you to ask me them rather than you sit there and think and wonder, because it is a bit noticeable. But at the same time, like once you know and you're like, okay, cool, you kind of forget about it. It's not like, oh, you know, really weird and like uncomfortable or anything. So I just kind of wanted to ask you, you know, what it's been like to live with an artificial eye. Have you ever had any issues or just kind of like what it's like?
Yeah, this actually ties in so well. I'm so glad you asked about this. So I was born with bilateral retinoblastoma, which is a cancer of the retinas in both eyes. And my right eye was cured through a series of treatments. My left eye was not. So when I was 3 years old, it was surgically replaced with a prosthetic one, which has changed over time. I've gotten new ones as I grew and developed and changed. And they kind of have to continuously be repainted to match the color of my real eye because our eyes do change color over time as we get older. So it's always been a part of my life, like going to see these various specialists who deal with all the implications associated. And it also, I mean, one of the things that got me accustomed to traveling a lot, even as a child, was we would go to New York for these treatments and for checkups. And I still do when I'm there. And so that was one of the things that got me used to constant motion and to constantly seeing people from all over the place who looked different and had different experiences. So it was already impacting me, aside from my physical state of well-being and my health. It was impacting me socially and sociologically in ways that I could never have appreciated until much later. In kind of in more practical terms, I can see, I mean, on the right side of my face, I can see essentially everything that everyone sees, just in a more limited range. My peripheral vision is less than half of what it should be. And it was supposed to affect my depth perception much more than it did. I wasn't even supposed to be able to pour a glass of water. But that has thankfully been much better than was projected. The biggest thing is that I can't really drive. I took a road test a couple times and failed it just because of sort of the limitations of the range of my vision. I was pretty good at driving. I was not very good at parking. That was really my downfall. So I have always, as long as I've lived in a place like the United States where car transportation is sort of the main form of transportation, at least for non-city dwellers, I have always relied on other people for transportation. And that got old very quickly, especially as I kind of progressed into adult life. So I always knew that I would really flourish and thrive best in a city and in a place where I had access to very reliable public transit. And even, you know, Europe being much older socially than the United States, and just the earth, the land being a certain way for a much longer period of time. You know, you have cars, but they're smaller in general, and people still rely heavily on trains for transportation between cities, between countries. And it's just a much more common form of transportation than it is even in the States. So, and Berlin, especially the BVG is pretty good with transit. So there's a reliable system network of trains and buses and trams. And it has never been an issue for me to get where I needed to go. And I was even, I saw a friend earlier today, and I was even telling her that when you get accustomed to public transportation, you also become very self-sufficient, and you get accustomed to relying on yourself to know where you're going, or if you can't figure it out immediately, if it isn't quite apparent to you from the start, you sort of plan routes and reroute in your head as you go along, and you learn to become very spontaneous. So that was always something that I knew would be best for me because of my limited vision. And I'm living in a city is good for people with kind of visual impairments as well, I think, because it causes you to become extra vigilant and extra aware of things, because people can always come out of nowhere and cars and vehicles and other things. So you have to become extra attuned to your surroundings. You really have to tune in. And I mean, kind of a funny story to wrap up that question. When I was at the visa appointment, where I would ultimately be approved for the visa, while they were doing the paperwork, they wanted to know what eye color to put on the papers. And the lawyer and kind of the visa officer both looked into my eyes and kind of argued over it. Because apparently there's no, I've always gone with hazel, but apparently there's really no German translation for hazel. So eventually they settled on brown, which is just blonde in German, auf Deutsch. But I realized at that point in time that it was the first time that any fuss had been made over my eyes. And in the United States, ever since I was very young, that was all people were doing was noticing my eyes, and you know, doctors were examining them, and other people that I encountered weren't really sure what to make of them. But this was the very first time in Berlin, and it's been 15 months now that I've been here.
Oh, that is so funny. and I mean, like, part of the, you know, like you said, there just isn't a translation for the color. But thanks. I really appreciate you sharing that story. Now, before I give the final wrap up, I'm going to ask a quick, random, fun question. And if this question doesn't work, we will have to pick another question. But I am making the flying assumption with different things that you have said that you are a fan of Harry Potter.
I am.
Okay, great. So we can ask the question then. My question is, what Hogwarts house do you define yourself as?
I would probably, like, I was never on Pottermore or any of kind of the more official representations, I guess I would call them. But I have always heavily identified with Ravenclaw. I think the sort of innate curiosity, because I don't think Ravenclaw is really about intelligence, quote unquote, in the way that people sort of, I think, automatically think of it as. I think it's more about curiosity and the willingness to be a lifelong learner, and just the eagerness to participate in the world and to learn a little bit more than you already knew. And if that isn't me, then I don't know what is.
Yes, I think that very much comes through with everything you've talked about today. And I appreciate you answering the question.
Of course. I want to say I think it's a real shame about J.K. Rowling.
Yes. But. Yeah, I know that. Everyone is...
That's always a disclaimer you have to do now.
Yes, it is. It is a good disclaimer to have. And everyone's, of course, dealing with it differently. But, you know, if you look at one thing and try to define it by its whole story, you're never going to love everything that you see.
Absolutely.
You know, like, if you look at the company Disney, there's so much involved in it. And you can love this one thing and say, hey, I really don't like this other thing. So I think, you know, we live in our world of the books, of the lore that she created, and that is what matters. And you know, she has chosen the way she wants to go, and she can do that.
That's a great perspective.
All right, that brings this episode to a close. For more information regarding Cecilia's YouTube channel, I highly recommend that you do check it out. She does have a lovely voice. It is linked in the description, and her other social medias, including Twitter and Instagram, are there as well. If you'd like to connect to the podcast, we are on Instagram and Facebook, and you can always email the podcast at introducingmepodcast@gmail.com. I encourage you to reach out. I'm always looking for new guests. And of course, there's the Patreon page that if you would want to support the podcast monetarily, you are more than welcome to. So thank you, Cecilia, so much for spending time with me today. I loved hearing all of your different little stories. And to my listeners, for taking the time out of your day to hear a new story. Until next time, bye.
Ciao. Auf Wiedersehen, everyone. Goodbye.